I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Thanks for joining us. Now, take a listen.
First of all, everybody grab a map.
That's the voice of Bita Becker. Now, you're going to meet her in a moment, but you will hear her suggestion to grab a map throughout the show today, because we are bringing you stories from several different locations. So, do you have your map? Good. Now, look at the western United States, where Colorado borders Utah, which is hugged by Nevada to its west and Arizona to its south. Follow that western edge of Arizona as it kisses California all the way into the bordering nation of Mexico. And you've just tracked the hardest working river in the country, the Colorado River. The Colorado River is responsible for 90% of water for Las Vegas, more than 80% for Tucson, and big portions of the supply for Los Angeles and Denver. The Colorado River supplies water for 40 million people, irrigates 6 million acres of land, and generates more than 4,000 megawatts of hydropower from its dams. The Colorado fuels a $1.4 trillion annual economy, and without it, none of the major cities of the southwestern United States could even exist. Also, the Colorado River is drying up. The Colorado feeds Lake Mead, the nation's largest man-made reservoir. And Lake Mead is now only 35% full. That's the lowest level since it was created nearly 100 years ago. Last week, the federal government declared the first ever water shortage for the Colorado River, and mandatory cutbacks began immediately. The effects will be far-reaching. Joining me today to explain how we got here and what's ahead is Bita Becker, an attorney with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. Bita, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. It's an honor.
And also with me is Brad Udall, Senior Water and Climate Scientist at Colorado State University. Brad, welcome to The Takeaway.
Melissa, great to see you, and Bita also.
Now, Brad, before we get into all of the details, can you just begin by helping our listeners to understand what is the importance of the Colorado River to this region and also maybe more broadly?
So the river supplies water to 40 million different Americans in seven states, and there are two nations, and importantly, there are 30 tribes that rely on this water. It goes to every major city in the American Southwest. It's 90% of Las Vegas' supply, 50% of Phoenix, 50% of Denver. 4.5 million acres of irrigated ag depend on this river. It's really hard to overstate how important it is to this part of the country.
Brad, walk us back a bit. How did we get here?
I mean, you can go back 100 years if you want to when the Colorado River Compact was signed in 1922, and perhaps that's the logical place to start here. The river was allocated at that time between the upper basin, the four states of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, and the lower basin, Arizona, California, and Nevada. Importantly, there were a number of players not at the table when the river was allocated. The environment was not at the table. The tribes were not at the table. Recreation was not at the table. And so what they did back then was, using, frankly, pretty crummy data, over-allocated the river. And this didn't matter for close to 100 years, call it 80 years, it didn't matter, because we didn't have the capacity to actually take all that water out of the river. But starting around 2000, we actually did have it. And something else happened in 2000, which is climate change started to affect the flow of the river. So since 2000, the flow is actually down 20%. So between overuse and a reduction in water supplies, we're now at a critical crunch point. And what's happened since 2000, the two largest reservoirs in the United States, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, they were 90% full. Flash forward to now, they're 30% full. We've drained 60% of them. That's 2 years worth of flow. And we're on our way, frankly, to draining them completely if we're not careful here. So there's a whole series of challenges around this, including the tribal one, which is figuring out how to do right by them, many of whom have never had a water right. And there's an enormous set of issues here to resolve.
And Bita, maybe you can also sort of dig in on the same question and help us to understand the critical significance, particularly to indigenous communities.
So we're talking about drinking water, agri water, all types of water use plus energy use. The reason I point that out is because for many tribal communities, Navajo included, we have a regrettably a high poverty rate. The hydropower is the cheapest power we can buy. So when hydropower gets threatened and then we have to go out and purchase higher cost power, we're just further impacting the challenges that our people are facing all at a time of COVID-19. One practical issue is that there's still a high level of water insecurity among tribal people living in the basin. For instance, on the Navajo Nation, it's estimated 30 to 40% of homes lack piped water, which is one of the reasons there was such a high outbreak of COVID-19 in Indian communities. The other aspect to raise is the spiritual, religious, and cultural nature of the river. That is also impacted. So just a cultural core of many, many people who lived in this area forever.
Maybe give us even just one example so that our listeners can understand, if they're not in these communities, sort of what that sense of something that was forever being critically threatened, what that means.
First of all, everybody grab a map and look at the border between Arizona and California. There are five tribes along that stretch of the river who have long lived there. And one of them is named the Kokopah tribe. And what the way they tell their story is, you know, the center of their universe is their river. The center of everything they believe in is the river. So when the river dries up or goes away, you're taking out kind of the center of their being. But what I also want to emphasize is it's not just true for people living in the United States, as Brad mentioned, it also serves Mexico. And so the river for a long time has dried up in Mexico. So not only does it affect the modern economics, which are so critical to daily life, but it also affects that, just that center of being, one's purpose of life.
So Brad, help our listeners to understand a little bit about the kind of day-to-day. What will the cutbacks mean so that as we're looking at this long arc, right, as we're thinking about the capacity for survival and maybe an equitable survival, what will these impending cutbacks mean?
So the first cutbacks are primarily imposed on the state of Arizona. And over the last 100 years, an enormously complex body of law and Supreme Court decisions and regulations have been put in place. And those rules, called the Law of the River, for some odd historical reasons, impose on Arizona the vast majority of these initial cuts. And so it means a number of farmers in central Arizona won't actually get water 2 years from now. Next year, they'll maybe get half of what they were going to get otherwise. They're going to go back to pumping groundwater, which is completely unsustainable in Arizona. And that's a whole nother problem. As this continues, though, and I think we have every reason to believe these cuts will continue out into the future, other entities are going to receive cutbacks as well, including ultimately the state of California. Ag users use about 70% of the water in the basin, and they're going to face the initial hits on this. That's one aspect of this. The reservoirs, unfortunately, are going to continue to drop to very low levels, including, as Beatha hinted at earlier, probably loss of power production out of the upper reservoir, Lake Powell, maybe as early as next year. So there's a whole series of cascading impacts, including what likely are going to be some permanent, not just temporary, permanent shortage reductions, shortages in deliveries to users. Municipal users, at least for a while, are going to get off and not face too much of an issue here. But in the long run, I have to tell you, I think, you know, we're going to get to rethink again how we're using every last drop of this river.
I'm actually a little worried to hear you say, Brad, that sort of endpoint consumers may not feel it right away, because so many of the communities that the two of you have described, farmers, indigenous communities, right, are the ones that oftentimes can be most easily forgotten, rendered invisible by our policymaking, especially, right, if my personal water bill isn't going up, if I'm not experiencing a personal shortage. So Bita, to your point about maybe allowing a moment like this to also constitute a pivot, a head knocking together pivot for how we ought to be engaging, are there ways that you would like to see shared sacrifice in order to move us more swiftly towards a more equitable future?
You know, I think shared sacrifice really begins with, you know, as you were saying, institutions, but also the individual recognizing their role in all of this. These issues aren't new, as Brad is saying. These issues aren't new. I mean, obviously, people have been preparing for this, and I think that's the good news. There are a lot of good people who have been preparing for this. I think your question is, how do we make this real for somebody living in Los Angeles or Albuquerque who's still watering their lawn, right? Like, why do you have a lawn? I think if we can figure out a way to take the reality of COVID that hit everybody, even people who deny it, it hit them, right? If policymakers can figure out a way to make that connection, that emotional connection. And I realize I'm being very lofty here, but I think that's, I think the actions of Congress infusing all of this funding, because that's a huge issue. That's a huge positive step in the right direction, meaning Congress is doing what it can to infuse, to play its role by infusing funding, infusing certain policy direction to get people, so people have the resources they need to focus on resilience. So the language we use, Melissa, is less about sacrifice and more about resilience.
So Brad, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
People in cities are going to be asked to contribute to this, no question about it. In order to resolve this, everybody's at the table. We will need continued municipal conservation. And I think what you're hinting at is a new ethic around water use. And, you know, a real appreciation for what happens when you turn that tap on, not just a, you know, mostly when you turn the tap on nowadays, you don't even think twice about it, right? I mean, we ask people where their water comes from and they say the tap. Well, yeah, kind of, but not really. You know, it comes from nature. Nature's going to bat last here. And ultimately, it's going to enforce upon us some fundamental changes for everybody. And one good thing, and I'll share some of Bita's optimism in the Colorado River Basin, is that there's a really good working group of people that has, you know, 100 years of working out issues, and especially over the last 20, a lot of cooperation, a lot of understanding. Here in this community, we understand what it means to take water away from farmers or what it means to ask Phoenix to conserve. And that's where I get my optimism, is the people that are working in this, and they understand each other's sensitivities and needs.
Brad Udall is a senior water and climate scientist at Colorado State University, and Bita Becker is an attorney with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. Thank you both for being here, and thank you both for shedding some light and optimism on a story that could feel very panic-driven. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Melissa.
My great pleasure to be with both of you.
Once again, this is Bita Becker.
First of all, everybody grab a map.
Okay, do you have your maps ready? Now, turn your attention away from the southwest United States and look all the way to the southeast, to Florida's southernmost big city, Miami. Track just 689 miles south of Miami through the Caribbean Sea, and you'll come to the island nation of Haiti, which was struck last week by a 7.2 magnitude earthquake that killed thousands and left many more injured and missing. More than 80,000 homes were destroyed in the earthquake, leaving tens of thousands without adequate shelter. Heavy rains from Tropical Depression Grace are further complicating the suffering and stalling relief efforts. And all this comes amid the continuing COVID-19 pandemic and a political crisis made worse by the recent assassination of President Jovenel Moise. Haiti is less than 700 miles from Miami, but U.S. borders remain closed to Haitians fleeing political crisis and the devastation of multiple disasters. For more on that, we're joined by Nicole Nerea, immigration reporter at Vox. Nicole, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So what is the current U.S. policy towards Haitian immigrants?
So there are a few things to consider here. First of all, there are Haitians arriving by the U.S.-Mexico border, but they're currently being kept out under what's called the Title 42 policy, which was implemented under the Trump administration at the outset of the pandemic last year, but it's a policy that Biden's opted to keep in place indefinitely. More than a million people, including Haitians, have been expelled back to Mexico or back to Haiti under that policy on pandemic-related grounds, though public health experts say there's no real epidemiological rationale for keeping that in place, and that people should be able to cross the border safely if the policy were lifted.
Can we pause just on that one policy aspect for just a moment? Because I wonder, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Haitians were also banned from U.S. immigration as a result of HIV/AIDS. And I'm wondering if there's some resonance of that in this policy.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, it's impossible to really look at these migration policies of the Biden administration and more recent administrations without sort of treating it as part of a legacy of disparate treatment of Haitian migrants on the part of the U.S. And so what you're referring to, like the most egregious example, was under the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, when Haitian boats were intercepted and the migrants were kept in an offshore migrant camp in Guantanamo Bay, in some cases under horrific conditions. And as you mentioned, a segment of those migrants were HIV positive, and Clinton didn't release them into the U.S. until he was backed into a corner by various court cases. So, you know, given that kind of legacy, these policies that have been implemented both at the U.S.-Mexico border, at sea, and you know, in deporting Haitians back to, you know, really turbulent conditions in their home country are all kind of part of that legacy, I'd say. And it also are sort of a contrast between what the Biden administration has responded on the ground in terms of actually delivering aid in Haiti versus how it's handling Haitians who are facing these increasingly difficult circumstances and arriving on the U.S.'s doorstep.
So why doesn't the temporary protected status, or TPS, apply in such a way that it would protect Haitians in this moment?
So the Biden administration did opt to expand TPS in the aftermath of the president's assassination in July, but that only applies to Haitians who were in the U.S. as of July 29th. And the Biden administration said that it's not actually planning to expand eligibility for TPS to Haitians who are continuing to arrive in the U.S. after the earthquake, and, you know, as political violence has escalated, gang violence has escalated on the ground. So that move did make another 100,000 or so Haitians eligible for TPS, but it's not really helping anyone who's trying to get to the U.S. now and seek protection.
So again, on folks who were already here, though, I know that there was a pause briefly earlier this year on deportation flights. Have those flights resumed? Are we actually sending people back to Haiti under these current disaster circumstances?
So there have been dozens of flights that the Biden administration has chartered to Haiti since he took office. One arrived just days before the earthquake hit, and these planes have been carrying vulnerable people like pregnant women and babies. So advocates are asking at this point for those flights to be put on hold indefinitely. The Biden administration did say that there weren't any deportation flights scheduled for last week, but the commitment doesn't really last any longer than that. So at this point, advocates are really looking for a bit of a longer term commitment, just because the conditions on the ground aren't going to meaningfully change over the course of a week or even months.
Help us understand the magnitude. How many Haitians typically seek entry into the U.S. on an annual basis?
So there's at least in a typical year in 2019, for example, which is the last year that we have data from the government, there were more than 140,000 Haitian immigrants who arrived in the U.S. legally. But there is a big diaspora population here of roughly 1.2 million Haitians. And so that may not account for all the people who are trying to get here. But it's also worth mentioning that there's somewhere between 5,000 to 10,000 Haitians waiting in Mexico for a chance to cross the U.S.-Mexico border at this point. And it's possible there may be more on their way. And one of the indicators of that is we're seeing migration levels at the Darien Gap, which is a migration corridor on the border of Panama and Colombia frequented by Haitians. Those levels have been higher this year than they have been in the last 3 years combined, with about 43,000 migrant crossings. So that suggests that more people are leaving the country and making their way through Central America.
So you mentioned the Biden administration's sort of focus on relief efforts in this moment, actually sort of in-country relief efforts. And I'm wondering, is that connected to sort of this, you know, as Vice President Harris articulated the, like, don't come, you know, please don't come, don't cross, you know, here. Is that kind of what we're seeing here? Or like, we'll help you in Haiti, but please don't come here?
Yeah, I think it is thematically sort of in the same vein. You know, the Biden administration has really focused its immigration policy on addressing the root causes of migration, as they're calling it. But they've had a very different stance towards migrants who are arriving at the U.S. border. And they did kind of explicitly say to Haitians, as well as Cubans who are fleeing political crisis, that they warned them against coming by boat because they will not be admitted to the U.S. So I think it very much is in the same vein of this rhetoric of don't come.
Nicole Nerea is an immigration reporter for Vox. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
First of all, everybody grab a map.
Okay, you got your map? Okay, now head up the east coast of the United States to the state of Georgia. There in Georgia, in the north central region of the state, you'll find Fulton County. Home to the city of Atlanta and more than 1 million residents, Fulton is the most populous county in Georgia. It's also the most racially diverse. 44% of the county is Black, 7% is Latino, and nearly 8% is Asian American. In the 2020 presidential election, 72.6% of voters cast their ballot for President Joe Biden. In short, Fulton is the fulcrum that flipped the Peach State, sending 16 Electoral College votes and two U.S. senators into the Democratic column. Republican lawmakers in Georgia are not amused. In March, they passed a sweeping new elections law, and the law provides a pathway for the Georgia State Board of Elections to review and possibly suspend a local election and to install a temporary administrator to oversee election administration. This week, the process of a state takeover of Fulton County elections began. Here with me is Stephen Fowler, political reporter with the Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Always a pleasure.
So what are Republican lawmakers saying about why this review is necessary in Fulton?
Well, it's important to note that Fulton County is Georgia's most populous county by a pretty wide margin. And with that, over history, there have been a number of problems with elections. For decades, there have been issues with voting machines and people not getting ballots they requested and long lines at the polls. And during the 2020 June primary, it was ground zero for this kind of disastrous primary where you had too few polling places, too few poll workers, too few machines, and just hours-long lines, predominantly in Black communities in Fulton County. You had people that requested absentee ballots that never got them. And so all around, there is precedence for Fulton County needing a little bit of extra review with how their elections are conducted. But they say the 2020 presidential election is something that also needs reviewing, and Republican lawmakers want to question that, but that's not necessarily the same as Fulton's history.
Yeah, so this is an odd, almost, we were talking about the state of Georgia flipping. It's almost like it's flipped in a weird way again. It's an inverse where the kinds of problems you're talking about, we've heard from activists, voting rights activists, we've heard from Democratic lawmakers for years. But then in 2020, it did seem that there was more accountability. I remember watching live stream Fulton for days and days on end. Is this just about whatever side is losing is mad, or is there something real going on here?
Well, it's really difficult to say. It's a combination of both. I mean, there are things that needed to be changed with Fulton County's elections, which they did. From June to November, they added more polling places. They add tens of millions of dollars more in funding. They pushed people to vote early and vote absentee so that there were no lines on election days. They trained a ton of new volunteer poll workers to handle it all. But even then, there were still some problems with absentee ballot counting, and things were delayed after the election was over because some things were scanned twice that didn't need to be. Some things weren't scanned that needed to be. And there were just some missteps in the process that needed to be fixed. But it does come on the heels of Georgia's historic election flip. And Fulton County is the county that has the most voters in it. So it's very easy to draw that line between Republicans losing in Georgia and Republicans losing the White House. But what's happening here is this takeover review tool, whatever you want to call it, is the surgical precision of a hammer instead of something more precise targeting the actual problems.
So what will this performance review entail?
This performance review is going to look at how the local elections board handles things. Now, it's a little bit confusing because when we typically think of elections, we think of a supervisor, one person in charge of things that trains people, that goes out and says, this is how many votes we have. But this law actually deals with the local elections board, which in Fulton County is bipartisan. There are five appointed members picked by the political parties and the county government. And that board is tasked with things like setting polling places, hearing challenges to people's voter registrations, and signing off on the results at the end of the day that this is what happened in the election. So there's a three-person panel that is going to be reviewing virtually every aspect of Fulton County's elections and how this board did its job. It's going to take months because Fulton is a big county. There's a lot of things that happened in the election. There's a lot of different processes from absentee ballot requests to absentee counting to polling places to equipment testing. And they're basically going to get a top to bottom review of how Fulton County conducted its elections recently, what the problems were, if there are any solutions that have already been put in place. And then eventually there will be a report saying whether they recommend that that board be suspended or if they take some other sort of action.
So it seems to me that there is kind of two big possibilities here, maybe more, but along a spectrum. One is that the review happens and ultimately the board is not replaced, right? It's kind of not taken over by the State Board of Elections. The other is that, you know, that it is in fact replaced by the State Board of Elections. But either way, does this cast a certain kind of public doubt about the efficacy, the honesty, the ability to have free and fair elections in Fulton? And does that have a consequence whether or not the state board takes over?
Absolutely. Like we mentioned earlier, Fulton County has a history of problems with its elections. This is now a new process where the state is coming in and examining every aspect of how Fulton County's run its elections. So as somebody who lives in Fulton County, you know, there are neighbors and people that are very concerned about this review for different reasons. You know, the two outcomes will be that this five-member bipartisan board will be temporarily suspended, and that's kind of a nuclear option. Or there will be some sort of report saying these are the steps that you need to fix before this very big 2022 election, where we have the governor's race and one U.S. Senate seat up. And, you know, it's still going to chart out a series of problems with how our votes are counted. And, you know, that's going to be the number one thing that both the Fulton County election staff and the state election board have said need to be fixed. During the meeting where they picked this panel, the Democratic state election board member said that she hoped that Fulton County kind of welcomed this, these outside eyes to come in and help show people that this is something they're taking seriously, that people can trust that their votes are counted fairly, and that everything should go out without a hitch, no matter where you live.
Is the federal government involved at all?
This is not something that the federal government is involved in per se, but there are 8 different federal lawsuits challenging just about every part of Georgia's 98-page voting law, including this takeover provision. You know, Democrats and voting rights groups say that this could amount to a hostile takeover of how local elections are run. Republicans say that this is just a review of counties that have maybe some less than stellar performances. And there are several lawsuits that say that that sort of wholesale ability to remove local elections officials and replace them with a single person does violate the Constitution. And that's currently being litigated and discussed in federal court.
Stephen Fowler is a political reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stephen, thanks for joining us, helping us to understand what's going on in Fulton. And I hope you'll come back and kind of keep us up to date as this continues to move forward.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Throughout the show, we've been encouraging you to grab your map. But now it's time to grab your calendar. Go ahead and mark October 1, because this is the date when the video and image sharing site OnlyFans will ban all sexually explicit content. Given that sexually explicit content is primarily responsible for the site's popularity, the company's announcement of the ban late last week has many people asking why and why now. Joining me now is Taylor Lorenz, technology reporter for the New York Times. Thank you for being here, Taylor.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So, Taylor, can you start by just explaining what exactly is OnlyFans?
OnlyFans is basically a social media site that allows users to post photos and videos, usually sexually explicit ones, and charge users a monthly fee. So it's kind of like a subscription service for individual content creators. Most of it is porn. So in order to access the content, you have to pay certain amounts per month determined by the different content creators. So it's not exactly like Instagram or Twitter where you can just scroll lots of free content. It's like Patreon, if you've ever heard of that.
Yep, absolutely. So that's helpful. Now, help me to understand sort of where it sits in the sort of broader social media or content creation worldview. Like, is it hot? Is it popular? Is it exciting? Is it something that, like, you know, only the young people care about? Where is it in that sort of overall world?
Yeah, OnlyFans has really exploded in the past year and a half and gone mainstream. It's definitely, I would say, a major social platform and player in the sort of the online creator space. But when the pandemic hit, it sort of became this like lifeline for a lot of people that were selling content. Like, it kind of went mainstream because it was adopted by a lot of influencers and celebrities in the past year. You know, Cardi B famously joined. You had the influencer Caroline Calloway. You have a lot of people that maybe you didn't traditionally think of as porn creators, like TikTok stars and YouTubers, suddenly creating sort of borderline explicit content on the site and monetizing that way. You also had a lot of former adult performers and strippers turning to OnlyFans as a lifeline during the pandemic to monetize digitally. And so it's just become like this massive subscription site that's really normalized creating sexually explicit content too in the eyes of a lot of content creators.
So why, if it's working, why break it, right? So why put out new, you know, acceptable use terms? Why decide on October 1st that you're done allowing this very content that made the site grow?
It's kind of crazy because, you know, sexually explicit content is sort of core to the site's user base. But basically what happened is the platform has sort of been struggling to find outside investment. So like every tech company, you know, it wants to scale. OnlyFans has about 114 million users, but they want to get to billions. So they started to look for outside investment and they encountered a bunch of problems. Despite the fact that they have tons of revenue, a lot of investors were really wary of investing in a site that was so heavily reliant on sexually explicit content. And specifically, they were worried about payment processing. Last year, MasterCard and Visa pulled out of Pornhub, and it was over concerns around child abuse and rape and things like that. So the concern is that some of that type of more problematic content could be on OnlyFans, and we don't really know if the site is moderating it well enough. And even if they're moderating it really well, these payment processors still might just consider it too much of a liability and pull out, which would leave the site in a really hard position. Investors are also, you know, they have a lot of clauses. A lot of them have these vice clauses so that they can't invest in porn-related sites. You know, they're basically looking to clean up the sites so that they can get more money and put themselves in a more sort of financially secure standing, I guess.
So what's their current revenue model?
They're currently making huge amounts of money. You know, they have net revenues of $1.2 billion in 2021. It's basically over 50% of OnlyFans revenue comes from paid subscriptions. So, you know, it's you pay a performer or an influencer $10 a month. OnlyFans takes a cut of that subscription fee, which amounts to a huge amount of revenue when you sort of add it all up.
Right. So it's again, it's like the sexy version of if you're a hairdresser and you rent your, your chair, right, in a salon, then, your customers are coming, they're paying you, but then you're paying a cut back, right? What I'm wondering here is that question of exploitation. I mean, I was reading the first version of acceptable use versus the new one, and there was very clear language about minors in the first one, saying, you know, if you can't use OnlyFans in any way that could exploit harm or attempt to exploit or harm any individual under 18. But I'm wondering, what do we know about general exploitation on the site? Yes, it's important to protect children, but, you know, what if you were filming someone who's 24 without their knowledge? Isn't that also exploitation?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen, especially as the site has become so popularized in the last year, too, we're seeing these OnlyFans content houses where, you know, people are moved in to create content, and most of the revenue can often go to like a management company. We've seen a lot of sort of shady managers emerge in this space. So in some ways there are concerns about that, but I will say OnlyFans is actually a lot more sort of safe and transparent than other, you know, facets of the porn industry. For instance, a lot of these porn production companies have been notoriously exploitative to their workers. So I think, you know, with OnlyFans, a lot of content creators on the site said, hey, this platform actually allows me autonomy. You know, for the first time in my career creating sexually explicit content, I own the content, I can monetize it directly. You know, I don't have to go through one of these predatory kind of middlemen. And so I think that's why you saw so many people really outraged about the closure. In terms of moderation, we just don't know. The company attached a transparency report in the press release last Thursday saying that they had taken down, you know, a certain amount of content and sort of trying to make the case that, look, we really do look for this problematic stuff. We want to make sure that there's no rape or things like that happening, that's being uploaded, like, you know, footage of actual crimes, which had happened, you know, with Pornhub. But it's a closed platform. So it's really hard for journalists or watchdogs to get a sense of the entire platform because everything is pay-gated. You know, it's not like Instagram where you can go around and run a search and see lots of stuff. So it's sort of hard, and you have to trust the company, which obviously, you know, we just don't know.
Yeah. Trust the company is typically not a good journalistic rule. Dayla Lorenz, thank you for joining us and for sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
For many sex workers, OnlyFans was a lifeline during the pandemic, offering an opportunity to pivot to virtual interactions while continuing to earn income. With me now is Alexis Jondet, who is an adult content creator, author of Angry Black Girl, and founder of Intellectual Media, a site dedicated to creating essays and videos on topics such as race, sexuality, and history. Alexis, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I am thrilled to have you join us today on The Takeaway. Start by just telling me what your initial reaction was to the OnlyFans content ban.
Disgust, but not surprise, because sex workers have been warning us about this for a while, seasoned sex workers. A lot of people who joined the platform in the past year out of extreme need, or, you know, just wanting to see what the hype was about. Maybe they weren't fully aware of the impending doom that was coming, you know, way before FOSTA and SESTA in 2018, but, you know, that's been brewing for the past few decades with groups like National Center on Sexual Exploitation, formerly known as Morality and Media. You know, I'm not surprised. A lot of us aren't surprised. We're used to being kicked off of platforms after making money for these platforms.
So let's talk about the National Center for around Sexual Exploitation, which has described OnlyFans as just like another site for the kind of movement of for exploitation. And certainly we know what happened, or at least those who've been following this know some of what happened around Pornhub. Talk to me about sort of the extent to which those concerns are real and realistic, and the extent to which they are kind of a moral panic that are ginned up.
Trafficking is an extremely important issue worldwide, not just sexual trafficking, but human labor trafficking that a lot of these groups don't even seem to focus on, especially those with billionaire backers who are very interested in protecting their business interests, but aren't so they're more concerned with the morality of sex and pornography, but they're not concerned with child laborers or illegal people being, you know, brought across state lines, being brought into the country for cheap labor. And I just like to say the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, for anybody who is thinking that this is just about, you know, people on OnlyFans who are doing, you know, dirty, nasty sexual things. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation is also targeting Amazon, Discord, Netflix, Reddit, Twitter. If you enjoy any of those apps or any of those services, they're not concerned about the human trafficking part of it. They are concerned about these apps being accessible to those who are sexually liberated. They are obsessed with policing the sex lives of consenting adults under the guise of tracking sexually exploited children.
So Alexis, I want to dig in on your point around sexual liberation, because one of the things that I love about sort of the work that you create is that you've talked about this work as work, right? So that when we say sex work is work or adult content creation is work, you make some really clear points about the necessity of being paid, earning an income, making a living, and not that it's all exclusively about some kind of theory of empowerment.
Yes, it's not exclusively about empowerment. When I mention liberating, I'm talking about the people who are enjoying the pornography that they're paying for as consenting adults. As for the people creating the pornography, sometimes it's liberating, sometimes it's just a job. The same way I have friends who wake up to go to their retail jobs, or they go to their call center jobs, or they have jobs. They're not passionate about their jobs, but they pay their bills with their jobs. And, you know, a lot of people are more concerned with adults and their sexual activities than why we have so much wealth inequality in this country. And the people who have a lot of problems with OnlyFans don't want to talk about how Facebook has reported over 84 million cases of child sex abuse material in 3 years compared to Pornhub's 118 in that same period of time. So I appreciate Taylor Lorenz's work from the previous segment, but it is worth noting that the companies need to be investing more in moderating across the board. And OnlyFans does do a better job than these porn sites, but there are also issues with Facebook and, you know, sites that do not let sex workers on. Facebook and Instagram being, you know, the prime examples I'm discussing here. But I'm sorry if I'm getting away from it. I'm a little angry.
because you have a whole book about being angry around this.
I have a couple of things going on. I'm a writer and a content creator. I'm speaking from a place of privilege. I'm hurt for the people I know who have been able to come up on OnlyFans and really, because there are a lot of Black women, trans women, a lot of people who exist outside of typical standards of beauty, typical standards of, you know, what is sexy, what should be paid for. If you look up the studies, you'll see that women of color, particularly Black women, are usually paid less for their sexual labor. There's a study in the early 2000s on in strip clubs showing that Black women usually get tipped less or they're expected to do more. So OnlyFans really leveled the playing field for a lot of people.
So, and say one more beat on OnlyFans for me around control, and particularly as you're talking about marginalized folks who are paid less. Also talk to me about the safety for sex workers and for content creators and the ways that OnlyFans addresses that.
For those people who will not be able to monetize themselves on OnlyFans, or if they'll have to turn away to sites that charge way more than 20% of the cut, yes, some of them, their lives are going to be impacted. Some of them may be in danger because they may need to turn to alternative modes to making money. And because, you know, FOSTA, SESTA, targeted Backpage and Craigslist and all the other sites that full service sex workers were able to keep themselves safe with, you will be hearing, you know, about lives being lost in the future. It will be dangerous.
I'm wondering if you're now feeling exploited by OnlyFans and other creators feeling exploited by OnlyFans, which clearly built its brand off of the work that you all were doing, and is now planning to ban the work that you all have been doing.
Yes, I do feel exploited, but I want to make it very clear to anybody listening to this how much sex work is an issue for all of us as workers in this country. Just because I have been exploited by OnlyFans, a lot of us have felt exploited by companies. This is a labor issue more than anything else. Yes, there's misogyny with this. There is religious puritan, like there are a lot of things at play, but at its core, and the thing that other Americans need to understand so that we can tackle not just issues with OnlyFans, but issues with, let's say, Amazon and their inability to pay their workers living wages and offer, you know, benefits while Jeff Bezos barely pays taxes, that kind of stuff. We need to start looking at it all as a labor issue. So yes, I do feel exploited by OnlyFans, but it's nothing new. It's nothing different from when I worked at, you know, my little $8.50 job at Victoria's Secret when I was 18, not allowed to sit down, had to wear heels, needed to be talked to any kind of way by rude people all the time for $8.50 an hour. So yeah, I mean, but it's exploitation is kind of a core part of the American experience at this point.
So what I appreciate, again, so much about not only this conversation, but about your work in general, is how you provide that expansive framework and context, right? So sex work is work. So let's think about work and labor and unionization and collective bargaining and all of those questions. Talk to me a little bit about something you were framing up for me earlier in our conversation, between the kind of like moral angst, you know, pearl grabbing, you know, pearl clutching distress that so much of the American public has about sex, while often not having that same kind of distress about violence, right? So the ways that you know, we want to protect, for example, young people from any so-called explicit content that is sexualized, even if it's consensual and not particularly, you know, graphic or something, but, you know, tend to allow very graphic, non-consensual images of violence, right, to enter children's lives much earlier on. What do you think is going on there in American culture?
Misogyny, racism, a lot of things go into play with this. People's religious beliefs that believe they, you know, they should be able to interfere in the lives of others and control what they do. But these are all, you know, deep-rooted things, as deep-rooted as racism and classism in this country. And it's something that I explore in depth on my series, Let's Talk About Sex History, which is available on YouTube. I talk about the ways that Americans, you know, not just because of America, but, you know, a worldwide history of misogyny and how we view women who dare to live outside of, you know, certain parameters. So of course those things leak into other things, homophobia, transphobia, and it's a big, deep issue that we can only tackle if we're being honest with each other about everything else, from racism to classism, ableism, all of these things. It's a complex issue that people really just, you know, need to discuss, in addition to, you know, why we are so okay with violence everywhere. Why is violence okay for the children to see? Why is violence okay for children to discuss? And it's strange, but it's American culture, and it's our history, and it's something we have to grapple with, because none of this is new at all.
Okay, targeting. One last question for you around OnlyFans more specifically, and it's about the vacuum, right, that will occur starting October 1. Do you know, are you expecting, will you be surprised if basically an entrepreneurial new startup space occurs that that allows this content to migrate? Because it does, I mean, like, you know, it got big fast in terms of the importance of, you know, the content creators that it was definitely providing platform for.
Yeah, but there are several other sites, and there always have been. And that's the thing that's bothered me with this is OnlyFans is, it's a brand. That's where a lot of the support comes from. So, you know, you had Beyonce name dropping OnlyFans, Cardi B joining OnlyFans, but there are, have been sites like this and there will continue to be sites like this for how much longer, I'm not sure, because of the payment processing and all of that stuff, but there won't be another site like OnlyFans in the immediate future with as much brand power. And that's unfortunate. I don't see that happening right now, because 20%, when you measure all the other apps next to OnlyFans, they're saying 25-30.
Alexis Jande, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for bringing fire analysis. Alexis Jande is adult content creator, author of Angry Black Girl, and founder of Intellectual Media. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, y'all, that's the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Our stories today sure did cross the map. We started on the West Coast, we ended on the World Wide Web. And if you're here on the East Coast where I am, I hope that you are warm, but not too warm, dry, and definitely safe. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.